This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Magnan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeublé.
And our topic this week is...
building testable code bases in Swift.
Oh, interesting. But first, I have some follow-up. First of all, I have to apologize for last episode because we had to release it a day late because I had a whole day power outage.
It's not your fault, but okay.
It's not my fault, but I could have done more things to be better prepared for it. Luckily, the Monday was Thanksgiving, so I could save the day. But yeah, not ideal, but I don't think it's a huge, huge deal. I think it's our first slip-up since the start of the show.
Is it?
I think the first time we've posted an episode late since the start of the show, yes.
I'm sure we did. I think you're trying to beat yourself a bit too much here. It's okay. We just enjoyed Thanksgiving one extra day.
Yep, you had something to listen to on your day off if you're Canadian, which is only like half the listeners. Anyway, aside from that, I want to go back and talk about an episode that we did last year about Gran Turismo 7, because something interesting has happened.
Because you're a traitor, you mean?
No, I'm not a traitor. First of all, we'll get to that. First of all, I want to talk about it without involving me and my guilt. So on that episode, we talked a little bit about the difference between the Gran Turismo series and Forza historically, and how Forza has traditionally been designed more around instant gratification. Like I said on that episode, like very often the vehicle you'll see on the cover of the game is the very first vehicle you will be driving in the game, because they want you to get to that experience as quickly as humanly possible. And Forza games, especially the Horizon subseries, have traditionally been focused around collecting a bunch of cars. And that what made that really, really interesting recently is when Forza Motorsport 8's press tour started happening, and they started saying, yeah, we're not doing that this time. They're focusing on a new campaign mode, which is called the Builder's Cup, which is more about having your project car, where you evolve it and upgrade it over time. And I think like one of the slogans, the marketing slogans for the game is like, built, not bought, which is like the implication that you're not buying new cars to do new races. You're actually building up your car over time, over the course of this campaign. It looks incredibly lengthy, and I think it's really interesting to see that flip happen on the Forza side. Another thing that's happening is that this is the first Forza game to be all-in live service. You cannot play this game offline, kind of like Gran Turismo 7. So they're occupying very similar space, except it's an interesting shift from the Forza side of things. And I was very, very interested in seeing how this was going to play out and how Forza fans were going to react and all of that stuff. Somewhat unsurprisingly to me, Forza fans aren't that into it. They've grown accustomed to sort of what Forza is, and they don't want it to change, kind of like Gran Turismo fans have grown accustomed to what Gran Turismo is, and they don't want it to change. And I think they're very different target audiences. But I still think, like, as a Gran Turismo fan, this is the version of Forza, Motorsport in particular, that has attracted me the most. And in fact, it has attracted me so much that I bought an Xbox Series S that I put in my bedroom and that I have been playing this game on for the past couple days. So, yeah, we will talk about this game surely over time. There is a crazy amount of content in this game. And that's sort of what's weird about it to me, is people are focusing more on the numbers. They're saying there are only 25 events in the entire game. And it's like, there are 25 events, 5 races each, where you have to play you have required practice laps, and you have lots of in race laps as well. So the starting races are like 3 practice laps and 5 laps. So it's very rare that you're ending an event within less than like 20-25 minutes, something to that effect. So I'm just playing this very, very slowly, and I'm enjoying it and taking my time. And it's a very different experience from Gran Turismo, but I have been enjoying it greatly. And I'm sure I'll have more thoughts about it in the coming weeks. I've only done one event, aside from the tutorial, and it's been a lot of fun so far. I do have some worries that it might get boring if you focus too much on the built not bought and sticking to the same car all the time thing. But I'm hoping that I'll see more restrictive events down the line that might force me to switch things up a bit. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
Good. Before we continue, I do have one question.
Mm-hmm.
Are we too late for you to include this in your game of the year?
Oh yeah, this is not in game of the year at all.
Okay, just want to make sure, because usually I know October is the limit, and I know you started that kind of like last week, so... But okay, I was interested to see what will be the impact on your game of the year selection. But I think that's closed. Good. Is that it?
Yep.
Perfect. So for the main topic this week, I've been teasing for a few months at this point that I'll have a few more developer / Swift related topics I wanted to tackle.
They said it couldn't be done.
Whoa, I never said it couldn't be done. I just said it was coming soon with an asterisk and a few mentioned that yes, it's coming, but not. But yes, so I think this episode, yes, I mentioned that it will be in relation with Swift code bases, but I think they are more or less my experience building code bases with the test first approach to them. And like, I want to define a few key elements of what I feel, especially in the past 2 years, why I focus on the past 2 months, because it's been the past 2 years that I've been more or less back fully into the development track at work. And during those past 2 years, I've seen that a lot of the way I've learned a lot, and new tools in Swift and in the language makes you do some changes in your app architecture or in your code base architectures to make them more testable. So I kind of want to define what is a testable code base, which type of tests I want to focus on tonight, because we're not going to do a bunch of all the tests in the test pyramid. We will be focusing on a few ones that you tend to do as a developer, generally speaking, and for sure try to discuss a few strategies, ideas, and things alike. So, Yannick, if you were to describe what makes a testable code bases, what would be your first thought?
Are we really having a job interview on the show? I wasn't prepared for this.
I know you were not prepared for this topic even. So, but yes, it's not a job interview, just one simple question.
Oh, simple. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm. Okay. Yeah. Good modularity, no mixed concerns in your classes and types.
Okay. I'll stop you there. Those two are great one. I think no mixed concerns, I think, is my first one I want to talk about, which is each section or each piece has a clear purpose. It doesn't do 10,000 things all at once. Each pieces are doing a few things and a few things great. I think this in generally is a good application architecture or even a code-based architecture's guideline, but for an approach where you want to be testable first, this is even more important, because the lesser things a part does, the easier it is to manage its dependencies. And here what I mean by dependencies is the thing it relies on from the other parts of the application, not like what we've discussed in the past, package manager, third party code bases that you want to include, or third party SDKs. It's really another part. A good example is maybe your network, your UI layer talks to a network API. So the network API in your code base, or the network client that talks to the API, would be in its own different system in your application. You also have dependencies that you don't control, or it's a system that you don't control. And I think a good example of that is the location manager, CL location manager on iOS. We were talking about an example today at work about the Taptic engine, things like that, where those are API provided by the app platform or the OS here that you want to interact with, but it's hard to abstract their side effects. Another point that I feel is really important is dependency injection of those dependencies, or how you compose different parts of your application. So it is straightforward to combine parts into a new feature set. It is also easy and straightforward to replace parts of your code base with mocks, and we'll talk about what I mean by mocks soon. And for sure, those replacement parts, you have a straightforward way to control how they behave, because the end goal of a test is to test all the different combination of your functionality or of a piece of working element in your code base, and making sure that it performs correctly with all the inputs and the outputs. Last up, I do really, really put emphasis on that, is that the code you write for testing your application should be reliable over time. It means here that if you run the tests without changing, I'm not meaning introducing bugs and things like that, but you run this exact same test suite today, tomorrow, in 10 years, ignoring the code base, but like if you repeat tests after tests after tests, if you were to run it for 24/7, it shall be always green. If it was green once, it should stay green. It should not be flaky. And that's even for tests, and we'll go there, because that's the one point, because the depending on which type of test you write, you might have to put different trade-offs, which means you might rely on more shim layers, which means you might introduce instability. But for what I want to focus on today, which is unit tests, is really important that you minimize, or even I would strongly suggest remove, the flaky tests. Fix them, disable them, do something, but you don't want to have developers that they press green, or you have to run the test suite 2 or 3 times to ensure that they see a green, because when they see an error, they should really go into the mode, oh, I broke something, not, oh, it's a flaky test again.
Yeah, one of the things I had on one of my mobile apps that was an inherited bad test that we had to deal with was if you had multiple CI pipelines running on the same runner in parallel, the tests mm-hmm. broke.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. That sounds like a recipe for disaster for sure.
Yep.
And that's why I won't be talking about continuous integration systems today. I think that could even be its own dedicated episode, which I'm not in the mood to do. So I'm making zero promise on that. But yeah, I mentioned this because here I'm focusing about the code base itself, the way you build it, the way you architect it. If your app delegate, to use an iOS specific example, does literally half of the logic of your application, it's hard to then test this said app delegate to do, oh, I receive a push notification, or then I wanted to ensure that when the app boots, the UI is in the right state. If it's hard to separate those concerns into different chunks, services, modules, then it means writing tests. It's hard, and again, integrating tests into an existing code base is a bit that. So I'm putting aside that, let's say you have a code base that has no tests and you want to evolve it. Yes, there is an amount of work that needs to be done on the tooling side. And here, tooling, I mean, like you mentioned, like continuous integration server, having a CI pipeline, things like that. That is pushed aside. And I know it's a big kind of pushing aside, but for today's episode, we shall do it. But yes, to come back on the point, tests shall be reliable. And the situation that Nick has mentioned, I think is, I wouldn't like to work in that type of code. But especially if you have an approach where, that's maybe the last tangent I'll put on the kind of continuous integration, is like, yeah, you open pull requests and you want to ensure that you haven't broke anything. So having the stress of, oh yeah, my tests are red. Did I break something again? I rerun them. Oh no, it's green now. So did I break something? Did I introduce something? Did I introduce a race condition? That means that sometimes the tests are broken, sometimes they're not. It's really removing, I guess it's introducing insanity in your own development. Good. Would you, in the different I just mentioned of what makes a test, code base testable, would you add anything else?
I don't know. My brain is fried, dude. I've been working all day. That's okay. I don't know.
That's okay. That's okay. But to me, that I think that's where I want to focus, because it will impact how you build those tests down the road. And I mentioned again, Tonight, this episode, this week, we'll be focusing on unit tests. And this is unit tests in the test pyramid. So it means you build a test for the smallest element in your code base. Whereas like integration or even UI test might test a chunk of your application. So an integration test might just test your payment flow, whereas even unit tests or test automation will test the whole application, like if it was the user tapping on the screen, if we're talking about mobile devices.
Just to get a barometer feeling for you, like,
yes,
because I have some experience with mobile development and my company, but I don't really know what's going on outside my company in terms of like what is commonly done for testing. So would you say that the most frequently implemented tests are unit tests, and then it falls off for integration tests, and then it falls off even more for UI automation tests?
Yeah, and that's why they use the if you read a lot of the literature about building tests, that's why they talk about the test pyramid, because at the base of the pyramid there's the unit test, which is the one that you should run write the most and run the most frequently. Mm-hmm. And the higher you go in the pyramid, and again I might be mixing in the order, but my understanding is like unit test is at the base and then the UI test at the top, because the pyramid is for like the complexity involved and the frequency and the number of tests that shall be written goes down, but like the complexity goes up to the top of the pyramid. So in the end, you build your confidence in your product and your code base by having a lot of unit tests. Then to ensure that all those units can talk to each other, you might have a few integration tests, and then you might have a few API paths where you rely on automation technologies to then do UI automation tests, where you would really like, okay, I'll take an example from work. We're a point of sale system, so you want to make a restaurant order, and then you punch in a few items, and then you want to make pay. So then you build those, but those, they can be, even with Apple's technology or even other technology like Appium, those can be quite flaky.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of time off or things like that. We're still kind of, to me, writing those types of, especially your UI automation, it feels like you're programming a robot to act like a human.
Yeah.
And kind of quoting, oh yeah, I see that this binary is like, maybe the network is not too great today and things like that. And I can wake a half a fraction of a second before I tap on the button. But for sure, the computer, if you tell it to wait like 5 seconds and the button hasn't changed state, then it will fail your test.
Mm-hmm. One of the clients I had this year, we had to step up the testing game significantly because whether it was justified or not, they thought we weren't testing enough. And we had these giant suites of manual system integration tests that we had to run. And we were looking at tools like Appium and stuff like that. We were like, can we streamline this as much as possible to mm-hmm. have it as much of it automated as possible? But when it's like, step one, do something in the app. Step two, flip a switch on an external device. It's like, well, Appium can't do anything about that, so we can't use it for those tests. And it really sucked that we were so limited in what tests could actually be automated that it wasn't even worth implementing them.
Agreed. And this is a good example because at the same time, the closer you go to UI automation, there is a fraction in the testing community that should say, hey, because it's you're automating the UI, so you're kind of replacing the user and testing as a user, you should also run with the least mocking of services. Mm-hmm. Like it should be the real app. But like I mentioned, any network delay, if it's talked to a real server, for example, or it waits for a print job to print because it's talking to hardware, any delays in the network could really thrown off those suites. So there's kind of this balance or middle ground where you want to possibly build fake systems for your automation, but you don't want to build them too much because then what's the value yeah. of automating your UI? Which, this is why I want to focus on unit tests, because to me that's been a personal opinion I have even at work, that not everybody is in a full agreement of that, but I'm a big proponent of building a solid unit test suite, which is kind of good enough in my book compared to the return of investment or the investment you need in the return that it gets from those suites. Yes, like you can use the same argument that I'm not saying it doesn't find bugs and things like that. It doesn't improve your confidence level to ship frequently, but the investment in time in coding and things like that, the higher you go in the pyramid, the more you have to invest. And sometimes I feel that this balance where we're investing a lot of people's time to maintain this infrastructure and maintain those tests, I am less convinced at that level. Whereas with unit tests, there shall be a few thousand tests, but they run like so fast, few milliseconds, that like, yeah, if it takes 15-20 minutes, that's not too bad. And at least they are 100% reliable. They're no flaky. Because one of the main reasons that happens is because you want to test you want to manage the dependencies and also control the dependency injection. It does mean that when you test a unit, you do replace all of its dependencies with something you control, which is not something that happens higher up in the test pyramid. Good. Before we go talk about possible solutions you might have heard from colleagues and things you should start implementing in Swift, I kind of want to do a small detour on definition, because I have a link in the show notes from Martin Fowler. And this article is quite interesting because first, every time I kind of like, okay, I want to refresh my mind of the testing literature, I always find the way back to this article. So it seems that when people talk about definition, they talk about like strategies or even ways to architect code base. This has been kind of now more or less being common knowledge because I think this article was written in 2007. So it's that. And even this time around for episode preparation, I accidentally came back to it. And this time, and every time I come back to it, there's always a part of the article I'm like, oh yeah, it kind of like links with more recent work or more recent knowledge I want to focus on. And this time around, the part that stick was the definition, because you might hear I use already the word mocks. What is a mock? You might have heard spies, stub, and you might have heard those terms as kind of being interchangeable, but in the end they're not really, because here Fowler has something to say about that. And I'll read a quote from his article, which is a bit weird because it's a quote of him quoting somebody else. So if you heard the name Gerard Mezaros, and I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing, it's because he's kind of quoting somebody else, part of his own explanation. So I go. So Mezaros used the term testable as a generic term for any kind of pretend object used in place of a real object for testing purposes. The name comes from a notion of a stunt double. They also define five particular kinds of double. Dummy objects are passed around but never actually used. They are just used to fill in parameters. Fake objects have a working implementation but are usually take some shortcuts, which makes them not suitable for production. An in-memory database is a good example, and we'll come back to that soon. Stubs provide canned answers to call made during the test, usually not responding at all to anything outside what's programmed in for the tests. Spies are stubs that also record some information based on how they were called. One form of this might be an email service that records how many messages it was sent. And last but not least, mock are what we are talking about here, objects pre-programmed with expectations which form a specification of the call that they are expected to receive. End quote. And the reason I quote this big chunk, and again, this article I think is way longer than just this big chunk, even if it's currently a big quote, is I love this definition because I've talked with colleagues a lot and we say stub, spy, mock, and we kind of try to speak the same language, but sometimes it's hard to get that. And here is that each testable, as what they use as a generic term, they each of them have a clear goal. The dummy is dummy. It means that it is something you expect, that it is just to ensure that maybe your unit that you're currently testing really passes two parts of your code base, one to each other. So if it's more an orchestration object that you are unit testing, this dummy here will ensure that, okay, if I initialize this unit that I'm testing with that dummy, if I then call an endpoint to on it, I'm expected to get that dummy object of it, because I'm expecting part of this contract from this unit to receive this object too. Fake, like I said, that we would come back, I use all the time, because this is one of the best way to test core data application. I would say for me, it is the recommended approach to unit testing. Core data logic is to use core data's in-memory storage. Remember in previous core data episode, we discussed about the backing store. There's XML, there's SQLite, that is mostly the one you use. But the third one that is really nice is in-memory. So it means that you can more or less initialize all your core data logic and just say, hey, just store it on in-memory, which means that each test cases can end up with a new clean slate in your core data test, which is pretty neat, because you don't end up having reliability issues. Oh, I have some logic from one test that impact another test, which can happen if you're doing persistent slash database testing.
Importantly, even if you're not using core data, but if you're using SQLite directly, SQLite can also do it in memory with the right initialization string.
Right, exactly. I'm sure this is just a shim on top of the SQLite implementation. Just sending the right parameters to SQLite to just do that too. But what I've seen personally, ignoring the fix, is really a mix of the stub, spies, and mocks. And I would say, in the end, you really want to have spies and mocks as much as you can, because they give you two important things. Yes, you can configure them like stubs, but they record a lot of information. The example, to go back to the spy, if you call them, it will record, hey, you called my send email method with these parameters. And then you can ask it, give me the number of calls you've had, your parameter, and it can validate that yes, you called that dependencies with the right parameter. And off top on that, mocks are even pre-programmed, meaning that the expectations and the pre-canned information like stubs, you can configure them and then pass them, and you're not. The idea here is those are flexible enough usually that you can configure them differently for different test purposes. So you will hear them interchangeably, stubs, spies, and mock, but think about it that the higher you go here, in theory, the more information you need to configure, and then the better you can validate what happened when you run a test with them. Like with stubs, you cannot really validate whether a functionality of a stub was called or not. Just imply that if you get the right data from your subject under test, which is the unit you're testing currently, and it returns you this output, maybe it's because it called the stub correctly, but maybe not. It might have figured out something else and you might have a bug because of that. Okay, so now that we have these definition, I'll try my best for the remainder of the episode that when I mean mocks, I use the mock verbiage. But even in preparation for this episode, I was even in my notes, I realized, I made a mistake here. I use stubs, but I mean the mock and things like that. But these definitions bring us to possible solutions for testable or for how to test code bases in Swift. And I make a small diversion to talk about our good old friend Objective-C, because I was reminded of the first mocking framework that I've used, which was called OCmock, which heavily relied / abuse of the Objective-C runtime. But at least this is one of the more, even to this day, this is the one of the rare examples where I could say OCmock is a real mock object framework per the definition we've just seen, because you tell it The gist of it is it uses the objective runtime to more or less kind of make a replica of a specific type, but you are defining what you expect to be called on, and if it's not, if those functionality, those methods are not called on this object, you expect the test to fail. Whereas if it was a spy, it would record, but if it's not called, who cares? Like, there's no enforced validation that something has happened. And OSIMUG gives you the tool for that by appending expect calls. You also have stub calls to say, hey, I expect you'll be called. I want you to return this data, but I don't care for the amount of time you've been called and you have returned that data. I like just blindly returned the canned data and I don't care. Whereas with expect, you would ensure the number of times. So if you call expect three times, expect like an addition of 1+1. If you do one expect, you assume this function will be called once. If you do two twice, you expect that it's called twice and twice only, not three, not one, two. So that's what we mean by expectation and forming a specification by defining how you expect the user of the mock to react, you more or less building the behavior of your unit. That was really nice at the time where we were writing a lot of Objective-C, but now that we're slowly, not slowly, but really moving away from Objective-C and also using NS objects everywhere, this is a tool that we use less and less. But what I realized though is it's powerfulness is kind of sometimes missed. It is also really tedious sometimes to write tests because you have to make sure that everything is mocked correctly and stubbed correctly. But that also came with how we were writing application. And at that time, we were writing it in a quote-unquote typical model view controller architecture with the downside that sometimes a lot of times I should say, the controllers was doing too much. And by doing too much, we had to manage a lot of the dependencies, which in the end meant providing a lot of mock objects and building a lot of expectation, a lot of stubs on those mocks to ensure that they would manage all of that logic. With the advent of Swift, it did bring a lot of functional programming to the iOS land. And even on the Apple side, there's been a big push on protocol-oriented programming. This has a really nice benefit because if everything is defined in a protocol, aka a definition that says, okay, I expect a specific unit to do X, Y, and Z, and then my unit conforms to that protocol, so it ensures it does the right thing, you can then, quote unquote, pass in a different value type, that implements this protocol correctly. So in your running application or in your live application, you provide it, let's say we're talking about Corridor, your persistence layer, but in your test, in the users of your persistence layer, you might just pass in this in-memory stub that allows you to talk to a live but not stored on disk implementation. What I've maybe don't like, this is a good example of it gives you more flexibility on writing test side, but at the same time, I feel that you have to make a lot of compromises on how you write your code to make it happen, which reminds me of kind of the recommended approach to Java development, where you always have an interface and an implementation, and not like what we used to do in Objective-C, where we have an header file and an implementation file. Here, it's more you end up with you have a point class, and then you have a point implementation that conforms to the interface to implement it correctly. Also, protocol-oriented programming allows you to create spies, stubs, and maybe mock. But the mocks, while not impossible, are quite label intensive to create. Because one of the patterns you might end up doing is, again, like having to implement all the logic to create, okay, I want to ensure that I call this method only once. So you have to write the logic yourself. I haven't seen dynamic tool as dynamic as what I've seen with OCMUG that like is able to do inference on a protocol and then give you those expects so that it knows, okay, if you call, if you notify or if you make certain calls on the mock object to tell it, I expect these methods to be called with these parameter 1, 2, 3, 4 times. I'll also expect those methods to be just stubbed, so return a canned response. A lot of that I've seen that it's more or less you have to create it yourself, which means it's quite labor intensive. And the way I mean by creating yourself is you have to have different implementations. You might have for the one protocol, a spy implementation that just record, or a mock implementation, or just a stub implementation that you might also use as your dummy. So you end up with maybe 4 or 5 or version specific for each test file, which is the approach I've seen a lot and I've done a lot to give you those benefits. Another way to kind of do the mock behavior is calling a fatal error to more or less crash the test. But again, some might say that it's less than ideal to do so, but it kind of works. Xcode XCT test framework also have XCT fail. We can just, that does the same thing where you ensure that if this is ever called, like you return an error saying, hey, this was never supposed to be called. So you could build a dummy that does that too, right? To ensure that when you pass it around, somebody is not accidentally calling a method on it. Because the most important part of when you write unit tests is to ensure what you've written does what it shall do. Because more or less the unit has one thing to do and one thing it should do great, and you need to validate that. So you really need to give it a constrained environment when writing unit tests. Another approach to protocol-oriented programming that was more a bit, I'll say this one more old school, is for sure doing the exact same thing but by subclassing. In object-oriented programming languages, you can do more or less the same just by subclassing everything. But at the same time, Swift in the more recent years is moving away from having a lot of the definition of objects be marked as open, which means that they can be subclass outside of their defining module and to public, or even mark a lot of classes as final, which means you cannot ever subclass them. So that's why protocol-oriented programming has gained a lot in popularity in the past 3, 4, 5 years of Swift adoption. To minimize on the boilerplate of creating all of those double manually, I've seen plug-in Linux code, I've seen other tools, but they still more or less do what you have to do manually, but with a bit of automation. And to me at this point, like, you can just identify the objects, the struct that you have to create, the mock version, the spy version, and the fake version or the stub version, and ensure that those are accessible for your old test suite, and you end up more or less with the same result just by having spent one afternoon to just do it for the most important parts of your code base. Another pattern that is to help you to help you inject dependencies, which means y'all can also control said dependencies when you test, is the initializer / provider pattern. The one I call the initializer pattern, which means like in a unit, when you initialize it, you need to provide all the dependencies it needs during its lifetime when you initialize it. So no, you initialize it and then you pass it dependencies with variable, with function method. No, everything is in the init, which is nice because for the whole lifetime of this object, they have a known set of dependencies. And also when they get deallocated, then it is clear when they don't need those dependencies anymore. And what I've seen that I call the provider pattern, I think it's a pattern that originates from the C# Microsoft world. I have seen it on the web, but the idea is to build protocol, build object that you pass in your inits that define that all those dependencies. So you don't end up with multiple parameters in your init that says, okay, let's say I want to have my network client, I want the location manager on iOS as each dependency. You end up with one big object and with some like protocol definition and things like that. You end up to fine-tune the object you receive, but if you were to look at the real definition, this provider object is just a big object. I don't want to call it a singleton, but it's a single definition of all your dependencies in your application that gets resolved for most of your units, but they each of your units have a view on it on the dependencies in need. So a good example is if I want to have a component that shows my current location, I might just ask my provider to give me the location manager and not give me the persistence layer. So I can fine tune what's presented. But what happens with that is because the provider object needs to pass in everywhere, you might end up that the second you need to add a dependency on the leaf component, let's say a small view or a small service that is dependent on another service, the second you want to add something, the service on top of it or the view on top of it needs to know about said dependencies. So you have to usually have a lot of boilerplate code to ensure that this is passed correctly. So we're still at this stage where we have a lot of tools to help, but they always have, I would say, important trade-offs on how you write your day-to-day code to help you have a better testable code base. And that's where more recently I've discovered the library that helps on that. The idea being that you want to minimize the modification to your app architecture or to your day-to-day coding to ensure also that you do have, you're able to write as much tests as you can and also write great tests that test all the different combination of functionality of an object without having to, I'll call it sacrifice, but impact your ideal architecture. And if we were to take the provider pattern or protocol or enter programming, the idea for those is, okay, yeah, you have to define everything in an interface. And it's for this one, it sucks because then everything becomes just an interface and you don't have the real concrete types. For the provider pattern, you have to just if you need to update one dependency in the leaf node of your code base, then it has to be updated through the root, so meaning to the main application, just to get this dependency. And of course, we were not the only one to experience this problem. So there has been people that are trying to fix said problem to provide a way to define code dependencies or different services and application as dependencies in a way that makes them easily to test, but also easy to control, and also doesn't impact too much the way you write your day-to-day code. And that's where we discovered our great friends at Point Freeco. This is a website for more or less functional programming in Swift. It is a web series / learning material. So it's a subscription service and it is made by both Steven Seelis and Brendan Williams. And throughout the 5-6 years of its existence, it has really, it is, I think the best way to say it is, you've seen that those two have been had experience with building code bases with a testable approach first, and they've struggled with it in the past. They're still struggling with it, but their thinking is this shall be something better that happened in development for iOS development. So they're pushing towards for that, and they're not only pushing with educational content, they're also pushing it with code. And they've launched a library called Swift Dependencies, which allows you to help you take control of your dependencies and provide built-in capabilities to replace said dependencies in your tests, and also for using it in Swift UI with Swift previews, because certain dependencies, location manager, I think there's some sound synthesis. I think the example I always give is the speech synthesis tools. They don't work on the sim, I'm pretty confident on the sim, and I'm 100% confident on Swift previews. So they give you that as an example to extract, like I mentioned at the beginning, abstract system parts that you don't control, or a system that you don't control, and try to be able to not control it, but be able to mimic its behavior, so that when you write tests code against it, then you can write tests against it to ensure that your own code does the right thing in all the different outputs you can receive from those system. This library, Swift Dependencies, is pretty interesting because it is inspired by Swift UI's environment system, where you don't need to pass in everything. It relies on protocol. I say protocol witness, but that's not what I'm looking for. Property wrapper, excuse me, which means that, for example, to go back to our example of using a provider that is passed in at an end time, if a leaf view needs to access, or a leaf view model needs to have access to a specific dependencies, its parent view doesn't need to know about it, because even if the dependencies provider or even a renderer is centralized, it is not passed around. Like, all your parts of the code base will have access to it, and then at that time when it runs at runtime, it will look at at the dependencies that are available at that time. So it has been a library that we've been exploring at work that I'm pretty enjoying to help control. And that's the nice thing, because the way you expose your code dependencies, they use the concept of using struct with a lot of closures in them, so that it's just it becomes your service definition. So it is easily replaceable with REST, because it's a struct with closure, so you can just create a new struct with closures that does different things in it, even if the closure kind of represents all your service endpoints or your dependencies endpoints. So it makes it's really easy to replace, and of course they offer you a way to incheck them in the system, so that when you have a unit to test, you don't need to pass it in. It just, when it gets run in your test, it has an overridden dependencies injected already. So for this library, I'll have a link in the show notes, because without going into much more details, without talking about code, I think it is really a strong suggestion. I've been really enjoying it. It's not perfect again. You have to think a bit differently of how you manage your dependencies, and especially the way they are exposed, because they're always present. The second your app is running, they are present, and you might have different part of your code base that needs to be properly logged in, or it works correctly when you have a logged in user and things like that. So I have to manage those dependencies in such a way that they're always present in your application. And it is a problem that I've not encountered in previous solution to abstract different parts of a code base and making sure that they are more easily replaceable for your testing purposes. So at that point, I've covered the definitions. I've covered the different ways I hope that this convinced you that you need to, not you need, but that there is values to writing tests. I think that's kind of always what I've seen with people that maybe struggle to say, oh, we need to write tests and things like that, is it's the value of doing that work that will not pay off today nor tomorrow, but down the road. But the idea behind it too is nowadays there's even way more ways, especially for Swift UI, Swift code base, excuse me, that you can do it in such a way that brings you great benefit without having to impact too much your, with minimal impact on your overall app architecture. So these days you can write reinitfs where you can have them reliable, control your dependencies without impacting too much the day-to-day code you have to write. For sure, you have to write the tests, but you can more or less follow the quote-unquote guidelines around building a Swift code base and ensure that you have proper test coverage and unit tests. And that's it.
All right. I've been looking at the Swift dependencies example code while you were talking.
Yes. And
it's kind of breaking my brain a bit. It's okay. Such a Swifty way of doing things that is not at all what I was expecting the library to look like. It looks maybe more resilient than what I'm used to from .NET dependency injection frameworks. At the same time, I don't think I'm a fan of their approach, but it certainly addresses issues that I've had with the .NET approach of things. I think I mentioned it on the Xamarin episode that I had inherited a project where it took a minute and a half to launch the app because the dependency injection hierarchy was ridiculously stupid. And this seems to be a lot more focused around, maybe I'm wrong, but mostly based around like limiting the lifetime of your dependencies to the lifetime of the object that requires them. Or I guess it's configurable, as I can see, but like the default seems to be like that.
Not really, because again, they will be present the second you load your application, or even let's say you add a new module that expose itself as a dependency from Swift dependencies. They'll be around, like they get loaded not instantly, but they get loaded part of it. But having them loaded in your application doesn't mean they're ready to use.
Right. They're just initialized or whatever.
They're initialized. You might have, like, and a good example for that is I've built code in the recent months where I expose a core data persistence layer behind it. But having a core data layer initialized is not enough. Like, we need to make a certain operation on the file system for it to be properly initialized, for it to accept storing requests or persistence requests. Mm-hmm. And that is your job as when you build your service. And that I didn't touch too much, because now we're slowly but surely moving into how you architect your whole application to work with that. And this is also another fun topic. But the idea with this is it would be your job as, let's say, as building a module exposed with that library, that you'd have to say, okay, yeah, it is initialized, but if I call stored before I call like load persistence, I expect an error because the persistence is not loaded or it's not created on disk. So you would still have to have those moments in your app's lifecycle where you make those calls, where you say, okay, no, it is the right moment to load persistence. And maybe it's expecting, like, let's say a username to have a different. Again, I don't have a clear example of where I'm going with this, but you want to have a persistence layer per your logged in user. So you might want to have the user ID. But to do that, you need to ensure that you've logged in, because to have the user ID, you talk with your API and then you have all that. So it would be your own code base that takes care of filling in this data. A good example of what I've seen of that is people expect, sometimes the dependency is nil. And then I have all the states, and then it can be present. That's not
Yeah.
Feasible, yes, but not how this system wants to work for sure. You're kind of like going against the flow by doing that. So for sure, this is the approach that I've seen that is a bit off the typical path you would expect when you would do dependency management yourself, where you say, okay, I expect my persistence layer to be present in the code, or not in the code, but present in the running of the application when I have logged in as a user, because I was able to talk to my server, get a token, get my user ID, and now I'm able to create a local persistence file on disk with my user ID so that my persistence service gets created. So you might already build an architecture around that where the previous parts of your application in your lifecycle where you're not logged in, it cannot talk to the persistence service. Mm-hmm. At the Swift dependencies, it will still be present if you start talking to it. But yeah, you have to manage that.
Yeah. I guess my point isn't entirely valid, because the architecture, the app architecture I inherited was one where not only was everything allocated at startup, which itself was surprisingly slow given the limited hardware we had access to, but also every single service was started at the same time.
Right.
And then everything was, the entire app was running as soon as it booted. And I think like the expectation, because Microsoft's dependency injection framework was developed for server applications, it mimics very much what you see in server boot sequences, where you register all the services, you start all the services, and then you never touch the system ever again. And because everything was sort of baked with those assumptions, it's a very poor match for mobile applications, where you can't just sit on a launch screen for a minute and a half and have that fly. Whereas when you reboot a server, it's going to happen very rarely, and maybe you don't care that it takes a minute and a half to start your server, because you probably have another server on the load balancer to handle that for you in the meantime.
Right, and it's kind of funny you bring all of this up, because the more I work with this, is the more you have to kind of use a bit of this tool, a bit of that tool. Because again, now we're kind of slowly diverging this topic into how you build services in Incubase. But this is quite important to, it's hard to talk about a testable code base without talking about the architecture of it, without talking how every services module, again, we're not going tonight into the definition of what is a module, but let's say a bunch of features or a bunch of functionality, like a network layer or a persistence layer or a logger, all of these work with each other. And for sure, when you want to test one, you don't want to test one with the other with the live implementation. You want to control those dependencies, and you get tools like Swift dependencies to control those dependencies. But you still don't have a framework to create mocks. Like, it's still your job where you might have to rely on creating Strock where you put the data yourself, or creating, at least they allow you to replace what those dependency does, but they still don't do like a mock does. Yes, it replaces, but doesn't expect. It doesn't create a set of features, a feature to test, because it's just controlling what a service, how a service is accessed, and it's easy to replace what a service does with a different implementation that makes more sense for your test. So I hope that with all of this, you kind of see that there, you kind of need a bit of everything I've just discussed to get closer to the near impossible perfect solution, but to get to something that is way more than just manageable every day. That is something you can thrive on and have as a team a goal of saying like, hey, we are testable first in our code base. And again, I wouldn't be surprised that a year from now I'll discover yet a bunch more tools and small trade-offs that you need to do to just continue on this approach of being testable first. It's never an end goal, is what I've learned in the past decade of doing iOS development in testable first code bases. Is it is a mantra that as a team you need to push forward and always continue pushing forward, because if you stop, then your test start to cripple your team, and then for sure it is always something you need to be constantly putting energy on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting to think about this at this particular time frame, because on Tuesday I'm going to be starting as tech lead on a new project, which is going to be our company's first Flutter project. Just to be clear, it's not a technical decision we made. It is a decision that was imposed on us by the client. So I'm thinking about all of these things in preparation for starting the new project, which is like, what are all of these things I need to figure out so that development can go smoothly and that the architecture, we don't make like huge architecture mistakes that makes the whole app shit. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff to think about. And I think the likelihood that non-programmers have made it to this point in the episode is fairly low. But if you have managed to stick it out to the entire end of the episode, like, I hope you can appreciate that we're just talking about making your code testable and we're barely scratching the surface. Software development is really fucking hard if you want to do it right.
Yeah. And like I said, like, I have the opportunity to work in what I would... even what I've seen with talking with other iOS devs, in a place where we try to push testability forward. And again, if you listen to a lot of other iOS devs, you might not hear them talk that much or that extensively about testing. I'm pretty happy like people like Stephen and Brendan are around having like educational material. Yes, you have to pay for it. Like, don't get me wrong, they're making a great career for doing that, but they've been out there. Mm-hmm. And when I started in iOS development, even just 10 years ago, like, that was not like that. You just had people saying, you just do it, right? And I'm glad to see that people are out there pushing for it. And that's kind of the goal I wanted to start as. I'm not promising my next episode is on programming, but I was really happy to decide to start with this topic on my kind of as my first topic of programming in a while.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that in a couple episodes I'll have other testing related topics to bring up, because I'm trying to ramp up some internal stuff at work, and I want to throw it out on the show as well once I have something more concrete.
Yeah, it is something throughout the years that you've shared on the show, because you have more experience into. I am aware, and I have a lot. I'm talking as you right now, just to be clear, that you have some amount of knowledge about proper testing techniques, but it was always either a struggle or some business decision made that it was always hard to push forward with this. So I'm always eager when you're able to say, oh, I'm able to make a decision or help push testing forward and maybe trying to build a testable first approach in a project I'm building. So, like, again, here, a lot of my experience is like everybody agrees with that, or the people that make the decision agrees with that. So I'm here to kind of help this culture nurture in the code bases I write, but starting from scratch is sometimes something I'm quite eager to think about or would like to do, but then I kind of dread it. So yeah. I always like to hear your thoughts about that, because you are on that side where you have to introduce it to a code base.
To be clear, my company does do a lot of testing internally. However, it's not applied universally to all projects the same. We are taking on more and more medical projects, and medical projects obviously require more thorough testing reports and standards. So as we ramp up the proportion of those projects, more and more projects get very fleshed out unit test suites. So unit testing is increasing. We also have a member on the team who is focused entirely on testing now, like a test specialist, which is great. Nice. So we're getting there. It's just there are still problem points that I'm identifying that are really bugging me, and I am trying to get management to do something about it. And that's my tease for a future episode. I don't know when we're going to do it, but future.
Hey, and I'm glad you kind of jumped in at the end, because I kind of realized I forgot to ask you if you have any thoughts, which means that we wouldn't have talked about what we just discussed. And this is really great insights I forgot to mention in the episode. So really happy that you stopped me in my conclusion, saying like, I have this. That's good.
Cool. So if you want to find the show notes for this episode, you can find them at limitlesspossibility.net/215. The show is on the Fediverse. We are at limipo_podcast at mastodon.social. That's LIMIPO_podcast. We are also individually on the Fediverse. I am at Sakarina at icosahedron.website, and Luc Olivier is at
Luco at mastodon.social.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.